built in the Dalmuir shipyards in Glasgow, 180 metres long, with a crew of 400. 4 years after Ursula's voyage, the mighty ship began ferrying a different sort of passenger. Between 1938 and 1940, as the Nazi persecution gathered pace, the ships of the Lloyd-Triestino line would transport 17,000 Jewish refugees to the safety of Shanghai. The liner was passing through the Suez Canal when Michael dropped his ball, which bounced off down the deck. A passenger trapped it with his foot before it rolled into the water and brought it back. Johann Patra raised his hat and introduced himself to the boy's mother as Ernst Schmidt of the Rheinmetall Typewriter Company. Ursula was wearing a pretty blue sleeveless dress she had bought in Prague. They pretended to fall into conversation. That night they dined together. And the next. If the other travellers noticed that the elegant young German woman seemed to be getting on remarkably well with the rich businessman, that was hardly exceptional aboard the SS Conte Verde. "Affairs on board ship were as normal as they are in spa towns," Ursula wrote. As they steamed south, the weather grew balmy. In the evenings, when Michael was asleep, they strolled the decks deep in conversation. During the day, they splashed in the swimming pool, played cards, or lay in deck chairs. "You are a good mother," Johann reassured Ursula. Back in Czechoslovakia, they had agreed not to discuss the mission on board, but Patra swiftly broke his own rule. Ursula had memorized the transmitting code to be used in Manchuria. "Have you remembered it?" asked Patra after breakfast one morning. She nodded and recited the code. He asked the same question the next day. At the third time of asking, she snapped, "Stop it, you can rely on me." He shot back in an undertone, "No, I don't know you well enough, and I am responsible for this mission." An hour later, she saw Patra and Michael happily building a bridge out of wooden blocks, and her irritation evaporated. "In the evenings, we would spend several hours on the deck under the starry sky, leaning on the railing and just looking out at the sea, without saying anything or talking quietly about the very different lives we had led, but which had led us to the same world outlook." She told him about her own childhood, her 3 years in China, and her recruitment by Richard Sorge. He described his life at sea and his continuing struggle to understand the literature of revolution. He asked her about Rudy. "Of course, you don't have to answer me," he added. "He is a good man. We grew apart. Yes, he was my first lover. How old was I then?" "I didn't ask you that." "No, no, it's not a secret. I was 18 and... no, there is no one else on the horizon." Patra had not asked her that either. The long voyage with its warm days and clear nights, the sun and the star-dusted sky, created an irresistible atmosphere, she wrote. "When we stood leaning over the ship's rail, looking down into the water, whispering or silent, I was no longer quite so sure about wanting our relationship to continue on a purely comradely basis." Patra seemed to dote on her son. His rare, swift smile was breath-stopping. Ironically, given their shared commitment to class war, they were sharply divided by class. His tastes were garish, and his manners were not those of a businessman, Ursula observed. People travelling in first class, she pointed out crisply, did not stick half-smoked cigarettes behind their ears. "I don't care about such little things, but it's part of the cover story that you should act like a bourgeois businessman." His failure to adapt was endangering them all. Enraged, Johann stalked off, saying he would sit somewhere else so as not to embarrass her. Ursula was dismayed. "How is this possible?" she reflected. "We've got enormous tasks ahead of us. We are the only communists on this ship. We know that we have to work together for a long time, and we have a dispute about something trivial like that?" Patra was trying to read Hegel's Science of Logic. This is something no one should ever feel obliged to do. Ursula watched him as he waded through the dense German, his face contorted with concentration. He appealed for help. With your education and a professor as a father, you'll be able to understand all this without difficulty. Ursula replied that she had never read a word of Hegel, and that an 800-page 19th-century book of German dialectical metaphysics was not her idea of deck-chair reading. "It's much easier for you," he retorted, "but you are too lazy to put in the necessary work. I'm just as dedicated as you, but I don't have to prove it by ploughing through Hegel." A little later, he proudly showed her a postcard he had written to his mother in Lithuania, a hideously kitsch castle bathed in a pink sunset. "It's the most expensive one the purser had," he said. "Don't you think that's beautiful?" "No, it's gaudy," she answered truthfully, and immediately regretted it. "I see," Patra hissed furiously, tearing up the postcard. "Well, I'm only a worker, and I don't understand these things, a barbarian with no culture, whereas you're an intellectual." Now she was angry. "That's enough. I will no longer let you squeeze me into this role. I've worked as a communist too long for that, and if you continue like this, I will lose all respect for you." Patra took a step back. "I didn't mean that," he mumbled. They came from different worlds, the rough-edged Baltic seaman and the middle-class German-Jewish woman of letters. He seemed to be annoyed by any advantage I might have acquired in life. My education, my fluent English, my greater confidence in handling people. That evening, after tucking Michael into his berth, she found Johann on the stern deck, gloomily smoking his pipe on a pile of rigging. She was determined to patch up the quarrel. "Spontaneously, I told him everything I admired about him, his ardour and sensitivity, his zeal, his enormous willpower and his greater experience. Shall I tell you what I think of you?" he replied. He spoke fluently, as if narrating a bitter story from memory. "Every morning she appears in a different dress in order to show off her admittedly good figure, and every morning she smiles amiably to at least 20 people. She likes making new acquaintances, but she doesn't care that this lot here are all petty bourgeois. She sparkles with her knowledge of English and French, especially in the presence of her uneducated travel companion, who doesn't understand a word. And she takes pleasure in making him aware that he is only a prole who doesn't know how to behave. He didn't stand up when she came into the room. How embarrassing. And he spooned the sauce from his plate, and he kept his cigarette butts. When he makes such mistakes, she attacks him like a hawk. He is a communist and has learned and learned, but not good manners. The party has used him, the sailor, for courier services. Once, in Brazil, the police caught him. He had incriminating letters with him and managed to tear himself free. They fired at him. The shot grazed his shoulder. He escaped and hid for 3 days, missed his ship, was left without a penny, and all the time he forgot to ensure that he learned good manners. Now he's on this damn steamer, for the first time in bourgeois society, and knows he mustn't stand out. He's constantly watching the fine nincompoops, observing everything, what fork they shove into their mouths, how they do not eat sandwiches by hand, but cut them into small pieces and impale them on sticks. He sweats like a ship's boiler. He's so damned insecure. But what sort of understanding could an intellectual from a rich family have of that? No one had ever spoken to Ursula this way. She felt her anger rise. Never before had anyone thought me stuffy, vain, pleasure-seeking, or malicious. "Take a few deep breaths," she told herself. Then she replied, "May I answer your charges one by one? I don't think you have to wait until we have a classless society to be friendly with individuals from other classes. Being happy is the flip side of being friendly, and it does not mean superficiality. If I am depressed, I try to be alone so as not to influence others with my bad mood. You're right, I like getting to know people. People interest me greatly. They are whimsical, funny, sad, bad, admirable. Everyone has their own fate, through society and through themselves. And now the ridiculous dress question. I have 4 of them. Of course I enjoy putting them on. Don't you feel how pleasurable it is, coming out of a cold March, to discard the old winter clothes and suddenly to be in a southern summer, to run around sleeveless and without stockings, to lie in the sun, to swim in the pool. I thought you were enjoying all this too. These are our pleasant hours. So those are the little things. Your other accusations are much more serious. Patra interrupted. Before you go on talking, those are pleasant hours for me too. Then he walked away. The next day, the ship docked at Colombo. The three of them went ashore, the little boy screeching in delight at the sight of the monkeys in the trees. They sat in a hillside cafe, overlooking the sea, Michael on Patra's lap. That evening, at sundown, as the liner steamed out of port, they leaned on the rail again, side by side. Our arms touched, as one's arm might brush a neighbour on a crowded train. I moved my arm a bit further away.
You don't have to be afraid, said Patra.
Don't I?
A pause.
It's late. I have to check on Misha.
Are you coming back again?
It's late.
I'll wait here.
When she returned, Patra was gazing out across the ocean. He did not hear her approach. She thought, go and stroke back the hair that is blowing in his face. Instead, she quietly stood alongside him. Much of this is my fault, she said, but I don't know how long I can endure it if you insult me like that.
Would you leave if you could? He asked.
Why think about something that is impossible?
I wouldn't leave you.
Patra fell silent, staring down at the stern wave. But then he looked up, gazed out over the water, looked at me and stroked the hair from my face. A point had been passed. But still she held back. She had loved and lost one fellow spy already. I resisted succumbing to the atmosphere of an ocean voyage, with romantic evenings and constant togetherness. They would soon be working together. He was her senior officer. In many ways they were incompatible. She told herself, rather let there be no beginning than a tortuous path with no end, because the work will keep us chained together. She was powerfully drawn to him, the heady combination of physical desire, forbidden love, and the promise of adventure. Patra was pressing, but patient. I know there is something serious between us, but if you don't see it that way yet, I can wait. The two spies were sailing to China to fight an underground war in which both might well perish. The other passengers on the Conte Verde saw only a happy young couple falling in love. Chapter 8. Our Woman in Manchuria. Rudolf Hamburger was waiting on the dockside when the Italian liner steamed into Shanghai. The months without Ursula and Michael had been painfully lonely. Rudy had buried himself in his architectural work and the furniture business, fearful they might never return. And now here they were. His fair-haired son clutching a ball, his wife lovely in a sleeveless white dress, even more beautiful for the weight she had gained in Russia. He took them back to Avenue Joffre, his great happiness overflowing. The family was reunited. Patra withdrew quietly to a hotel. Rudy's happiness lasted just a few hours. It was not easy to tell him that we were only coming for a visit, Ursula later wrote. She and Michael would soon be heading north to Manchuria, she explained, as gently as she could, and they would not be travelling alone. A different sort of man might have launched into recriminations and remonstrations, demanding that she leave Michael with him, flinging around crockery, threats, or lawsuits. Rudy absorbed the grim announcement without a scene. He was very depressed, but, as always, calm. But he flatly refused to accept that this separation might be permanent. He would not give up his son or his wife. In his own way, Rudy was as obstinate as her. Rudy possessed a special kind of persistence which nobody would suspect beneath his gentle exterior, she wrote. He did not reproach me in any way or make any difficulties. He even accepted that I might not be living alone in Mukden. There was another factor in Rudy's stoicism. He knew Ursula would be carrying out secret party work in Manchuria.
Before, he had resented and resisted her espionage, but now he wholeheartedly endorsed it. He was a communist, he declared, propelled to action by the force of history. Their families were in exile, on the run, or facing mounting persecution. His homeland was in the grip of fascism. Refugees were streaming into Shanghai, and the club had become a nest of Nazis, where he, a Jew, was now unwelcome. Ursula observed the change in Rudy with wonder. He was no longer just a sympathizer holding back from commitment, but a communist who was ready to work with us. She felt a surge of admiration for the remarkable man she had married. But it did not make her love him again. 3 days after her return, Ursula caught a rickshaw to a small restaurant on the city outskirts, where Patra was waiting with a senior CCP official. The unnamed Chinese comrade explained that the invasion of Manchuria had brought Japanese forces to the border with Russia, threatening the Soviet Union itself. "Your task is therefore doubly important," he said. Communist partisans in the mountains were waging a ferocious guerrilla campaign against the Japanese occupiers. Manchuria is in a state of semi-war. Ursula and Johann would be the resistors' point of contact with Moscow. They must purchase parts for a radio transmitter receiver, travel by train to Mukden, and establish an operations base in the city. As the main Soviet intelligence outpost in Manchuria, they would be responsible for furnishing the rebels with money, weapons and explosives, sheltering fugitives, identifying individual partisans for training back in Moscow, recruiting and training local radio operators, and passing messages and intelligence back and forth between the center and the guerrilla leadership. The comrade described how to make contact with the partisans. As expatriate Europeans, they could move around more freely than the Chinese, but the Japanese would keep them under close surveillance, since anyone who enters Manchuria from China may be part of the anti-Japanese movement and thus a potential enemy. Finally, he described the risks. The Japanese couldn't simply make foreigners disappear as they did with the Chinese, but if they were caught by the Kempeitai, they would be tortured and then killed. Johann Patra went shopping for valves, rectifier and wiring. The homemade radio would need to be powered by two large iron transformers, weighing 5 pounds each. Since these were impossible to conceal in their luggage, they would have to be purchased on arrival in Mukden. Ursula needed a cover job, something literary. She visited Evans & Company, an American bookshop in Shanghai, and explained that she was moving to Mukden and offered herself as the shop's Manchurian representative. She would purchase a stock of books at wholesale prices, sell them at retail price to English readers, and keep any profit. Evans & Company agreed, happily providing her with a formal letter of appointment and a set of printed business cards. Ursula was now chief executive and sole representative of the Manchukuo Book Agency, specializing in educational, medical, and scientific books. And espionage. In mid-May 1934, shortly before they were due to depart for Mukden, Ursula left Michael in Rudy's care, explaining that she would return in 2 days' time. She did not tell him where she was going. That afternoon, she and Johann caught the train to the ancient city of Hangzhou, now Hangzhou, 2 hours to the southwest, and checked into a charming little two-story hotel surrounding a pretty courtyard garden. "It was a dreamy day," Ursula wrote. "Hand in hand, we walked through the old alleys, teeming with vendors and crowds of people. They stopped to watch a porcelain mender skillfully piecing together broken rice bowls. The old man carried an ingenious audible advertising device, a bamboo pole with a gong and two chains that emitted a tinkling chime as he walked along. In the garden of a Buddhist temple, they sat on a bench beside a small lake. We talked about Confucius, the Chinese Red Army, the lotus leaves on the ponds, the passers-by, Misha, and the trip to Mukden. We did not speak of the night ahead." Back at the hotel,
Johan went to fetch green tea. The sound of the mahjong players rose from the courtyard, the bone tiles clicking like muffled castanets. Cool air wafted through the paper window blinds, ruffling a mosquito net on the wide four-poster bed. Ursula was suddenly chilly. She put on Johan's jacket, remembering the moment a few months earlier when he had wrapped his coat around her as her teeth chattered with cold and anticipation. She put a hand in the jacket pocket and drew out a photograph. Johan, with his hand around the hip of a Chinese prostitute. A photo with the date, taken 5 days earlier in Shanghai. She was still staring at the picture when Johan entered with a tea tray. Seeing the photo in her hand, Patra broke into a guilty monologue. The usual trivial thousand words of thousands of men, self-justifying, urgent, and meaningless. It was just a souvenir. It meant nothing at all. A purely physical matter. Long forgotten. It was your fault. You shouldn't have. And I wouldn't have. And it has nothing at all to do with my feelings for you. Never again will I. Yell at me, hit me. You can't make such a little thing into. On and on. She said nothing. Later they climbed into the big bed. I only had to say, leave me alone, once, she wrote. Patra quickly fell asleep. Ursula lay awake, listening to the murmur of Chinese voices and the cold clatter of the mahjong tiles. On the long train journey to Mukden, little Michael sat between Ursula and Johan, chattering away as the soybean fields and tiny villages slid past. The radio valves were hidden inside rolled-up socks at the bottom of the suitcase. Johan reached for her hand. We can't let that stupid matter in Shanghai spoil everything. It doesn't matter. Come on, be cheerful like you used to be. Ursula said nothing. It seemed pointless to accuse him of being a completely different person from me and of being unable to understand how deeply he had hurt me. At the border, Japanese guards emptied every suitcase and piled their contents onto the platform. Johan had already stuffed the valves between the compartment seat cushions. The ancient walled city of Mukden was like a smaller, less glamorous version of Shanghai, a teeming warren of narrow streets and low brick houses interspersed with grand municipal buildings. A vast shanty town sprawled out from the fortified walls. The foreigners lived in their own enclave. Here, the expatriate population was more beleaguered, and the profits were fewer since foreigners had to compete with the incoming Japanese. A peculiar international flotsam had washed up in Mukden. Adventurers, crooks, nomads trying to escape the past or looking for a different future. One more unhappy wife running away with her lover excited little curiosity. The city was awash with opium dealers, criminals, and prostitutes. There would be plenty of opportunities for Johan to enlarge his photo collection, Ursula reflected bitterly. At the Yamato Hotel, they unpacked and deliberately left out their printed business cards for Rheinmetall and Evans & Company for the spies to find. That afternoon, Johan set out to find a hiding place for the radio parts. Ursula left one suitcase full and laid a small thread across the clasp. When they returned from dinner, the thread was gone. The snoopers had made an inspection. In the hotel, we didn't exchange a single word of importance. Every waiter was listening. It had been agreed that liaising with the partisans, the most dangerous task ahead, would fall to Ursula. General Berzin was emphatic. Patra should not be exposed to the greatest risk. Of the two-person team, she was the junior officer and the more expendable. Initial contact was due to take place not in Mukden, but in the city of Harbin, 400 miles to the north. Johan suddenly announced that he would be going instead of her. Why, she demanded, was he changing the agreed strategy? Well, you are a woman and a mother. Maybe it's too much for you. We knew that beforehand, she replied tartly. I'll take Misha with me.
You want to put the small child through that long journey and then leave him alone in a hotel for hours? It's out of the question. If you go, Misha will stay with me. Johan rehearsed the child's daily routine. Mealtimes, clothing, how much cod liver oil to spoon into him. You can relax as far as Misha is concerned, he said. Come back in one piece. Ursula hated Harbin, the largest city in Manchuria and home to thousands of white Russians who had fled the revolution. These were the deserving victims of historical forces, of course, but the ragged exiles made a pitiful sight, reduced to penury, crime, pulling rickshaws and prostitution. Many stood at corners begging, wrote Ursula. Of all the cities I have known, Harbin in those days was the most sinister. Ursula's instructions were to meet a partisan contact, identified as Lee, at a cemetery on the outskirts of the city an hour after sunset. She had always feared the darkness. It was a burden for me, because in our work many things took place during the night hours. Two drunks passed, swaying and singing. A man sidled up and stared. She waited for the identifying code word, but his expression suggested he was not there for espionage. She ran and hid behind a gravestone. She waited an hour beyond the appointed time, and then she returned to the welcome brightness of the hotel. She went back to the cemetery the next night, as instructed, but there was still no sign of the partisan. Why hadn't he come? Had he been arrested? Disconsolate, she caught the train back to Mukden. At the Yamato Hotel, Johan was so engrossed with feeding the boy supper, he did not notice Ursula entering the dining room. He had put Misha into a chair raised by a pillow and tied a napkin around him very carefully so that his neck hair did not get caught in the knot. He tasted the soup to make sure it wasn't too hot and put the spoon up to Misha's mouth. He wiped some liquid off the boy's chin, completely absorbed in his work. She felt an upwelling of love. Only when she was standing behind him did Johan turn his head. I am so relieved, he said quietly. Oh, Johan, what am I going to do with you? She put her arms around his neck. He held me tight for a long time. But later, when she told him of the failed rendezvous, Johan's temper flashed again. You have a wonderful talent for messing up your opportunities, he snapped. The same was true of him. They slept apart again that night. A backup meeting with Lee was scheduled for a week later. This time Johan insisted on going to Harbin himself. To her own annoyance, Ursula felt her anxiety rise as the hour for his return approached, then passed. Strange how quickly you get used to a person, she reflected. She paced the room, unable to read. Had he been arrested? Had they tortured Lee until he couldn't take any more and told them the location of the meeting? At midnight, Johan finally slipped into the room, looking drained. Lee had not turned up. He climbed into bed beside her. Relief brought a surge of passion that she no longer tried to resist. Everything else was good that night, she wrote. An alternative rendezvous was in the city of Fushun, 30 miles east, to be used in case the first failed. Ursula packed up her book supplies, sold a grand total of 5 books in Fushan, but returned elated. The partisan contact had appeared exactly on time. A tall, quiet, northern Chinese with economical gestures, who explained, using simple Chinese, fragments of pidgin English, and pencil sketches, that he was the leader of an underground communist unit consisting of workers, farmers, teachers, students, and street traders. Right, right, very good, he said repeatedly. Lee, he explained, had taken fright. The man gave his name as Chu, and explained that he urgently needed explosives for a planned attack on the South Manchurian railway line. Our work can finally begin, Ursula reflected back at the hotel as she sewed the notes from the meeting into the hem of her petticoat. 2 major hurdles remained. They needed transformers to power the transmitter receiver and a safe place from which to transmit. the Japanese were on the lookout for illegal wireless transmissions. Erecting an aerial on top of the hotel would have been dangerous and probably impossible. Ursula set off to find a permanent base that could serve as a transmitting station. Patra, meanwhile, scoured every radio shop in Mukden without finding usable transformers. Reluctantly, he boarded the train back to Shanghai. He would have to buy them in the city and then work out how to smuggle the bulky metal objects back across the border. Ursula told him to consult Rudy, insisting that, despite the strangeness of the situation, her husband was completely trustworthy. Japanese officials had requisitioned most of the available property in Mukden, but a few large houses had been abandoned by fleeing Chinese generals. One of these, a luxury villa behind high walls that had once belonged to a relative of the Manchurian warlord, General Zhang Xueliang, stood next door to Mukden's German club. Ursula took one look at the place and decided it was ostentatious, bleak, and way beyond their budget. But tucked in the corner of the grounds, she spotted a smaller stone building. The servant explained, with a snigger, that this had been purpose-built for the owner's mistress. A tunnel led to it from the garden of the main house, providing the amorous general with swift and secret access to his concubine. The little building lacked running water and had only a wood-burning stove for heat, but otherwise it was ideal. With three small wood-panelled rooms on the raised first floor, a basement kitchen, an enormous bed for the general and his mistress, and a built-in escape tunnel. No one could see into the rooms from the outside, and proximity to the German club was oddly satisfying. She would be fighting fascism next door to a building flying the swastika. For the first time in over a year, Ursula had a home, a nest. It was a pleasure to roll out a straw mat, hang up a picture, buy a vase. In Shanghai, Johann bought two heavy transformers 8 inches long. The Japanese border guards would have to be blind to miss them. Rudy came up with a solution. They bought a heavy wing-backed chair with thick upholstery, an ugly green-brown monster, and had it delivered to Avenue Joffre. Johann and Rudy turned the chair on its back, pulled out the tacks holding the sacking in place, and tied the two transformers to the internal springs with wire and cord. Then they pushed in the padding and tacked back the sacking. Nothing was visible, and the extra weight in the armchair was imperceptible. The chair was then sent to Mukden as rail freight. Rudy was probably still unaware of the blossoming relationship between his wife and her superior officer, and if he knew, he was far too civilized to make a fuss. Ursula's husband and her lover had completed their first joint mission, combining the spycraft of one with the soft furnishings expertise of the other. Back in Mukden, Ursula showed Johann around the new house. "Perhaps our bedroom should be here in front," he said, "then Misha next door, and the third could be our living room with the transmitter. Why are you looking at me like that?" She frowned. "I didn't know you thought we were moving in together." "I took that for granted now that everything is clear and good between us. Everybody knows you're with me." Ursula was adamant. Cohabitation was not on the cards. "I will rejoice at every minute you are with me, and that will be most of the time, day and night." "Then why not the whole time?" "Because I have a different rhythm of life, and you demand that I should be completely incorporated into yours. Sometimes I need to be alone." Ursula was falling in love with Johann, for his protective tenderness, his love of Misha, and his revolutionary zeal. But he was also irascible and domineering, an old-fashioned chauvinist who granted men more opportunities than women and found her independence an affront to his dignity. In a towering huff, Johann moved into the spare room of a German businessman. But Ursula was sure her insistence on maintaining a separate home was right. Like many touchy, assertive men, Patra's ego needed managing and massaging. "Gradually, I overcame the offence. I showed him my love without reservation, and I amazed myself how tame, compliant, and patient I became in all matters of work. But without the hours I had to myself, I probably could not have managed it. The ugly green chair duly arrived at Mukden Station. When Ursula and Johan carried it into the house and turned it upside down, they saw with horror that one of the transformers was hanging halfway out. The jolting journey had snapped the wire, and the sharp edge had worn through the sacking. A single frayed cord held it in place. A few more movements and the transformer would have fallen out, and even the most incompetent Japanese railway employee would have spotted it. Johan set to work assembling the radio, a Hartley transmitter receiver with a three-point system. He was a skilled technician, with nimble fingers, infinite patience, and phenomenal powers of concentration. He never looked at his watch, and never took a break. Finally, the set was assembled, a cumbersome, homemade monster of a machine, with heavy rectifier and transformers, large valves, and coils shaped by winding thick copper wire around an empty beer bottle. The radio parts were hidden in the bottom of an old camphorwood clothes trunk, concealed under a false internal shelf built by Johan, with folded blankets laid over the top. The hiding place would not evade an intensive search, but it would keep the equipment from the prying eyes of the servants. She placed a feather under the lid. If it was opened, she would know. The final task was to erect a Fuchs aerial over the roof. To a casual observer, this might look no different from a reception antenna for an ordinary radio. But if they were spotted putting it up, this would attract unwanted attention. It would have to be done at night. She told Johan to leave it to her. Ursula waited until Michael was sound asleep. Then she climbed onto the roof through a hatch in the attic with two long bamboo poles, pliers, a rope, and a roll of antennae wire in a knapsack. She tied the first pole to one chimney, with the wire running through a hole in the top as if through a bamboo needle. Then she shuffled along the apex of the roof with the other bamboo similarly threaded, with the wire passing between them, lashed that to the opposite chimney, and looped the end securely around the base. Treetops and roofs were visible in faint contours. Momentarily unbalanced, she leaned against the chimney, which seemed comforting in its thickness. But then she made the mistake of looking down into the endless obscure darkness. Suddenly, she was terrified. Coward, she told herself. Scaredy cat. There's no reason to fall at all, except in your imagination. Then Michael began to scream. Usually the boy slept deeply. Now he screamed without pause. She shuffled fast back along the roof, flung the rucksack through the hatch and dived in after it. The child's cries would surely wake the neighbours. Michael was sitting up in bed, sobbing. I have fizzy water in my fingers, he wailed. The boy had pins and needles from sleeping on his arm. Another argument against professional revolutionaries having children, she reflected ruefully, and let out an involuntary giggle. She rubbed Michael's little hand and stroked the child's head until his breathing grew regular again. Then she climbed back onto the roof. The next night, the radio was ready for testing. By prearrangement, they would transmit only at night, at different times, and on one of only two agreed wavelengths, to the Red Army receiving station in Vladivostok, codenamed Wiesbaden. Ursula sat at the desk, Johan linked up the batteries, and she tapped out a short coded message with nervous fingers. A few moments later, the acknowledgement came through, a faint patter of Morse code from distant Russia, a signal from the centre. We smiled happily at each other. The Red Army was not alone in listening out for Ursula's messages. Day and night, Japanese surveillance planes throbbed back and forth overhead, scouring the airwaves. If two of these picked up the signal simultaneously, they could pinpoint the location of the wireless. And if that happened, the Japanese secret police would pounce, and, quite soon, Ursula would be dead. Chapter 9. Vagabond Life. a Nazi moved in next door. Ursula had been living in the cottage less than a month when a new tenant took up residence in the main house on the estate. As a neighbour, Hans von Schlewitz was alarming in every respect. A German aristocrat, an arms dealer, and a Nazi with senior contacts in the Japanese administration. He was also fat and drunk. Ursula was ready to loathe him on sight and to quit the property at the first sign of danger. Von Schlewitz turned out to be charming, gentle, and ironic, living proof that political and class enemies can be rather funny and very useful. An old-fashioned monarchist of ancient bloodline, von Schlewitz regarded Hitler as an oik and hated the Nazi Party, which he had joined strictly out of commercial expediency. He was pot-bellied, bald, convivial, canny, and very amusing, a great storyteller and full of wit. He walked with a limp, the legacy of shrapnel picked up at Verdun. 30 pieces of steel are in there, he liked to say, slapping his enormous thigh. He worked closely with the Japanese military in Manchuria and was exceptionally talkative, especially when plastered, which was often. If you meet me somewhere and find I have had too much to drink, he told her, do me a favour and take me home. Von Schlewitz and Ursula became instant friends. I so much prefer conversing with you than with the German Philistines here, he said. He missed his own family back in Germany and took a shine to little Misha, encouraging him to slalom on his tricycle around the chairs in his vast dining room. He flirted extravagantly, more out of chivalry than intent, with the intelligent Jewish woman who lived in the garden cottage, and she flirted back. Johann Patra, the Aryan typewriter salesman, was still welcomed by the other expatriate Germans, but there were unpleasant rumblings about his Semitic girlfriend. Ursula forced herself to accompany him or von Schlewitz to the club and put up with the snide asides. The Japanese would be less suspicious of someone who consorted with Nazis. When von Schlewitz heard that Ursula had been subjected to racist remarks, he puffed up like a cockerel. If any German here touches so much as a hair on your head, tell me immediately. So far from posing a threat, the new neighbour was a blessing in heavy disguise. If the Japanese came for her, they would have to go through von Schlewitz. The attentions of the older man sparked Johann into a fit of jealousy. How old is this fascist? In his mid-50s, I think. He seems to impress you a lot. She told him not to be ridiculous, pointing out that von Schlewitz was old enough to be her father. He would never try anything on with me. You like to talk to that Nazi alcoholic, giggle over his compliments. If he knew what you were doing, he would shoot you. You should poison him instead of being nice to him. Johann, don't be so simple. We're not here to poison any Nazis. We have to get along with our fellow Germans. You do too, as part of our cover story. In truth, Ursula thoroughly enjoyed her flirtation with von Schlewitz, who was excellent company, good cover, and a handy source of military information. She was not the first spy to use sexual chemistry as a tool of espionage. Ursula's existence in Mukden was a bizarre mixture of danger and domesticity. A home life with Johann and Michael, a social life hobnobbing with fascists, and a third, hidden life as a Red Army officer coordinating communist paramilitary operations. Every meeting with the partisans involved risk, she later wrote. If our support for the partisans was discovered, we could expect the death penalty. How did we live with the dangers? Relatively calmly. If you are constantly in danger, there are only two possibilities. Get used to it or go crazy. We got used to it. Ursula went shopping for bombs for Chu. The sabotage instructors at Sparrow had taught her how to mix explosives from ordinary household products, including ammonium nitrate, sulfur, hydrochloric acid, sugar, aluminium, and permanganate. These ingredients could all be sourced in Mukden, but buying them together or in bulk would attract attention. At a downtown hardware shop, she asked for 10 pounds of ammonium nitrate, the white crystal used as garden fertilizer, which forms an explosive when mixed with aluminium powder or fuel oil. Misunderstanding her Chinese pronunciation, the shopkeeper returned with a hundredweight sack. She wheeled away her bonanza in the pram. Michael perched atop the makings for a 100-pound bomb. Johan constructed timers and fuses. Chu came to the house to pick up the explosives. "Right, right, very good," he beamed. The communist sabotage campaign intensified, with attacks on guard posts, Japanese-run factories, military convoys, and above all the railway system so vital to the Manchurian economy. Prearranged signals indicated whether an operation had been successful. "Only when I see the forked incision on the fourth tree on the right-hand side of the first crossroad on White Moon Street do I feel the burden taken off my shoulders," wrote Ursula. The Japanese-controlled press reported few details, but the repeated denunciations of terrorists and the savagery of Japanese countermeasures showed how effectively the underground war was being waged. Last month, anti-Japanese groups carried out 650 attacks in the Mukden province alone, she wrote to her family in July 1934. Ursula did not reveal her own role in those attacks. She did not, in fact, tell her parents very much at all. They knew only that their intrepid and wayward eldest daughter had left her husband in Shanghai and was working as an itinerant bookseller in northern China. "I am busy from morn till night," she said, truthfully, before adding, a little less honestly, "On no account must you worry about me. There is absolutely no need to. I live exactly the life I want to live and am very satisfied. Don't worry. Somewhere along the line, this vagabond life must cease." She did not say that it might well end in a Japanese execution cell. She signed herself, "Your erring but contented daughter." She made no mention of Johann Patra. Robert and Berta Kuczynski were now virtual vagabonds themselves. Many Jews were slow to appreciate the virulence of Nazi anti-Semitism, but attacks on Jews and Jewish property in Berlin were escalating. Jews would soon be excluded from military service, Jewish actors banned from the stage, and Jewish students prevented from taking exams in medicine, pharmacy, and the law. The concentration camp system expanded rapidly. Elizabeth Neif, Agnes Smedley's brilliant Jewish psychoanalyst, wrote a brief note, "Ich kann nicht mehr, I have had enough," and committed suicide. From Britain, Robert wrote to his sister Alice, urging her and her husband, Georg Dorpelen, to get out of Germany with their four children. Uncle Georg flatly refused, pointing out that he was a decorated war hero and a celebrated Jewish doctor. He would remain in his homeland, which he loved. In 1934, Berta finally sold the house on Schlachtensee at a much reduced price, packed up the family's belongings, and fled to England with her younger daughters, Barbara, Sabine, and Renata. There they were reunited with Robert, who had obtained a post at the London School of Economics, researching colonial demography. A little later, Brigitte joined them. Olga Moot, the family nanny, was offered the choice of whether to stay or go. As an Aryan, she faced no threat in Germany and could find another job in Berlin. Moreover, she spoke almost no English, and the Kaczynskis' prospects in Britain were, at best, uncertain. But she chose to stay with the family, and duly squeezed into a small rented flat in North London with the rest of them. The Kaczynskis were now refugees. Of Ursula's immediate family, only Jürgen remained in Berlin, dodging from one hiding place to another, writing unstoppably, the long-winded mouthpiece for an increasingly desperate communist party. Ursula's radio traffic to Vladivostok included reports on sabotage, partisan morale, Japanese counterinsurgency measures, and military and political intelligence gleaned from fellow expatriates, including von Schlewitz. She was transmitting and receiving messages at least twice a week, taking down the fastest incoming signals without making any mistakes. But it was frustrating, time-consuming work. The transmitter-receiver was weak. Frequently, the Vladivostok signal was jammed or unintelligible. The fragmented messages had to be repeated, time after time. She often sat down to begin the deciphering process at 3 a.m., working by a dim light behind shuttered windows, knowing that Michael would wake in a few hours. She dared not light the stove in case the smoke drew attention to her nocturnal activities. I sat at the Morse key in my tracksuit, wrapped in blankets, with fingerless gloves on my hands. Aeroplanes circled over the house. One day they were bound to catch me. I wanted so much to climb into my warm bed. Every transmission was a bout of Russian roulette. But when the radio was working well and the regulation 500 letters of text, divided into batches of five, lined up like ranks of soldiers marching into battle, she felt a strange, secret elation. My house with its closed shutters was like a fortress. Misha was fast asleep in the next room. The town slept. Only I was awake, sending news of the partisans into the ether. And in Vladivostok, a Red Army man was sitting and listening. They needed a backup team. Chu agreed to provide someone to be trained in radio operations. A young Chinese couple duly appeared, bringing greetings from the partisan leader and a ready-made cover story. Wang would teach Ursula Mandarin, while his wife, Xu Xin, a skilled seamstress, would mend and make her clothes and help with the housework and childcare. Wang was polite but ponderous, whereas Xu Xin possessed a hunger for knowledge, a decent command of English, and a visceral loathing for the Japanese. Despite her childlike looks, she had two children of her own, aged 4 and 2, who were living with her parents. Wang resembled Johan in his serious, thoughtful manner, and the amused, laughing Xu Xin was similar to me. The women struck up an immediate bond. She was so delightful. When she practiced Morse code, her fingers danced on the keypad. After each radio lesson, they would drink tea, complain about their menfolk, discuss politics, and tell the stories of their very different lives. Xu Xin made Ursula a wide summer coat with a concealed pocket in the lining, the size of 2 radio valves. One evening, the conversation took a dark turn. What would it be like to be captured by the Japanese? Are men or women better able to withstand imprisonment and torture? Do you think that the extra worry of leaving children behind would wear a mother down? Xu Xin wondered. Ursula was still pondering the question when Xu Xin volunteered her own answer. I don't think whether or not you will be able to bear it depends on the amount of suffering. Perhaps it's the children who make us strong. Michael was almost 4 years old, picking up Chinese from his playmates and expanding his vocabulary in 3 languages. Ursula delighted in his intelligent, pensive questions and his insatiable curiosity. I would love to have 4 children like him, she wrote. Patra had started collecting traditional Chinese musical instruments and took Michael with him on shopping expeditions. Ursula seldom accompanied them. Both would have found me an intrusion. She loved to see this uncomplicated relationship developing, for Johan was an instinctive parent. She wondered if they might one day have children of their own. Moscow did not know the partnership between the Mukden spies had become more than just professional, and she was happy to keep it that way. We worked well together, she wrote. He was more complicated than me, with his reserve, occasional anger, intolerance and nervousness,
and I had in the meantime learned not to irritate him, to give in to him in almost everything. In espionage, she trusted him completely. In love, less so. A young Russian woman rented the room next door to Johann, a slender, pretty doll, a pink bow in her yellow hair. Ursula was immediately suspicious. Ludmilla is soon going home to her parents in Harbin, Johann reported, a shade too airily. She resented her own jealousy, but reflected, I need to know where I am with this Casanova. Johann was irascible, demanding, and quite possibly unfaithful. Yet he was also tender, and despite his insecurities, strong. He was a considerate lover, and he knew how to build an excellent bomb. We loved each other, lived in danger together. We were comrades. I loved that he muttered in his dreams that he was proud of me when I looked good, worried when I stayed away too long, that we argued and then became reconciled, and longed for each other when the journeys separated us. She could talk to Johann about politics, revolution, and the funny remarks made by the little boy they almost shared. We talked about what Germany would be like when the Nazi era was over, and what communist Germany would be like. Johann was disheartened that so many working-class Germans had supported Hitler as he tightened his grip on power and turned on the Jews. I have lost confidence in my own class, he said. They agreed to celebrate when they sent the 100th radio transmission. After a rendezvous with Chu in the city of Anshan, a 2-hour train ride to the south, she went to the local market and spotted a porcelain mender, like the one they had seen in Hangzhou, an elderly fellow with a thin white beard. She noticed that his hands were trembling as he reassembled a broken bowl. They fell into a halting conversation, and she asked about the little porcelain gong he carried on a pole. The old man picked up the object. I'm working today for the last time, he said. I have sons, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and now in 3 days' time I will lie down to die. Ursula was momentarily speechless. The old man pressed the porcelain gong into her hand. Take it, he said. You will live long. That evening, back in Mukden, she told Johann the story of the porcelain mender repairing his last bowl, and handed him the little gong for his collection. A love token, promising longevity. In January 1935, Rudy came to visit, bringing presents for Michael and spare parts for the radio. Ursula informed Moscow, Rudy is now a convinced communist and does not want to stay politically inactive any longer. He returned a few months later, bringing bomb-making ingredients. Rudy spent hours playing with his son in the garden. Michael had grown close to Patra, but his father's sudden, unexpected, unexplained appearances were moments of the purest joy. Years later, in what he called phantom mosaic fragments, he recalled his childish memories, being swung around by his father in the garden, the texture of Rudy's tweed jacket on his cheek, his mother reading aloud until he fell asleep. A happy child of a happy German family in China. Rudy did not inquire about Ursula's relationship with Johann or demand to know when they were coming back to Shanghai. He exerted no pressure, but he had not given up on his family. Hamburger was a strange combination, a traditional-minded radical, a gentlemanly revolutionary. One friend later described him as the last Victorian communist. To keep up appearances, and for the sake of his son, he was prepared to play happy families, still hoping his own might be truly happy again one day. Early in 1935, Moscow ordered Patra to construct a wireless for Shushin and Wang. Ursula took the train to Tianjin with Michael and bought more radio valves, which she smuggled back across the border, sewn inside her son's teddy bear. A few weeks later, Shushin and Wang departed, taking with them the second radio set assembled by Johann. She did not know and did not ask where they were going.
I found the farewell to Shushin, my only friend, very difficult.